Subcommittee on Revenue Reform is open. Good evening, everyone. We're a little bit shorthanded today. Representative Nathanson is under the weather. Senator Burdick is coming late. And so we'll use this time to delve a little bit deeper into some of these business tax formats and dynamics from our LRO officer, Chris Alanak. And Chris, why don't you get us started?
Okay. Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So in OLIS, there's one handout, and it's kind of an odd collection of pieces of information responding to a couple of questions at a prior meeting, as well as drilling down a little bit in a slightly different way on the nature of that. Some questions emerged after OBI's presentation about kind of a subtraction method and addition method. And so I'm trying to approach that a different way here. And that's what I've entitled Conceptual Description of Tax Bases. So not at an extremely simple level, that top equation, we have profits for a company equals gross receipts minus input costs minus labor costs minus capital costs minus other costs. And so where gross receipts are the net take for the business for all of the, whether it's services or products that they sell to the public or private sectors, that's their intake. Their input costs, this is, it's been referred to a couple of different ways. It's cost of goods sold or it's purchases from other businesses. And no, go back to the same page. I'm on the same page. Okay. Yeah, there we go. And so those are input costs. Labor costs are, that's payroll. So it's wages and benefits, those kinds of things. Capital costs, that is interest and dividends for the use of capital. And then other costs would include things like rent and various miscellaneous costs. So given that equation, the intent here is for VAT to see how these different pieces fit together. But also, the income tax is just imposed on profit. So that profit is what the income tax rate is. And that's the smallest number, if you recall some of the graphs that we've looked at over the past couple of weeks, where gross receipts is that largest tax base, and then profit is the smallest tax base. So the income tax is imposed on profit, and the GRT, the gross receipts tax, is imposed on the gross receipts. And those are the two ends of the spectrum. In the middle, there are a lot of possibilities of what I've been referring to as a VAT, OBI referred to a BAT. They can have different names, but it's something in the middle here. And there were, I got some questions about the difference between a subtraction method and the addition method. And part of the confusion is that they're really one and the same. They're kind of mirror images of each other. So the subtraction method for the VAT base is you take receipts and you minus the input, you subtract the input costs. So you're starting with that large base and you subtract the input. Now that input could either be cost of goods sold or it could be purchases from other firms. It's really the input cost that a firm needs to do to produce its output. What is it buying from other firms to produce their output, whether it's tangible products, desks, chairs, or intangible software, so forth. Cost of goods sold is an accounting term. And so there are a lot of definitions in that, and there's a lot packed into that concept, but it pops up across these states when tying to federal law, because all of the states are embedded in working with the federal law, and COGS is a line on the federal form. So one easy way, and the states that we've talked about have implemented this kind of base, is subtract COGS, because then you can just point to the federal form as opposed to coming up with a different definition. So the subtraction method for the VAT base is receipts minus input costs. The addition method is the VAT base is the sum of labor costs, capital costs, other costs, and profits. So it's all of the other pieces. So whether we're talking about the subtraction method or the addition method, we're getting at the same kind of math, because the labor costs plus capital costs plus other costs plus profit equals receipts minus input costs. If that makes, maybe that's still not quite getting there.
What is the New Hampshire, is it additive?
So yes. So then moving into the next two slides. So the next one is a chart of the Michigan tax. And then the following that one is the New Hampshire. So if we bounce down to the New Hampshire one, this is actually the form, the 2017 tax form. So we can see that line one is dividends paid. Line two is compensation and wages paid or accrued. And then line three is interest paid or accrued. So you sum those three things, and that shows up in line four of the tax return, sum of lines one, two, and three. And that is the, what New Hampshire calls the taxable enterprise value tax base. And then they have the, you have the tax, line four multiplied by 0.0072. And that's their gross tax. That's their calculation. You sum those three things up, multiply by 7.2, or 0.0072, and that's your tax before credits. And then they offer some credits.
Can you, in your head, do a hypothetical company and kind of tell us how this would play out to, you know, Allenex Steel or something?
For both additive and subtractive, if you wouldn't mind.
No, the New Hampshire. Yeah.
Oh, just
the New Hampshire.
First this, and then maybe for the. Okay.
So the steel company.
Allenex Steel.
Okay, Allenex Steel. Allenex Steel buys their inputs. They buy the raw materials, and they have some. So that's not on the form, because that would be kind of the cost of goods sold or the purchase from other firms. And then the company pays wages to the labor. That's line two, compensation. And the company also has taken out some loans to finance some capital infrastructure. And we're paying interest on those loans. So that would be the interest paid. And then dividends paid would be, we have some outstanding stock. And so we pay dividends on those stock. And those two pieces, the lines one, two, and three, is the combination of our cost of labor and our cost of capital. And that gets totaled up, and that equals taxable enterprise value tax base. So the one piece of information that isn't on there is the cost of our inputs. So we could certainly, at least at a conceptual level, start with gross receipts and subtract that, the cost of goods sold or the purchases from other firms. And that would be a different way of getting into this approach.
But they didn't do that. So what's the policy rationale?
Most of the VATs exist are at a national level. And when you get to a subnational level, there can be challenges on this subtraction method. Because you have firms that, depending on where you're buying your inputs from, if they're local or if they're out of state, usually under the subtraction method, you would only subtract those purchases made from in-state firms and not out-of-state firms. So you can run afoul of the Interstate Commerce Clause. This is one of the concerns. And so this is where you end up going to an addition base. Now, I don't know all the details of what New Hampshire went through to arrive at this particular calculation. But that could be how they got there.
So I'm just trying to figure out why they picked dividends, compensation, and interest as opposed to cost of goods sold.
Well, that's the one side of the equation where they've just gone directly to the addition method. Mm-hmm. Is okay, it's a value-added tax, and the value-added is payments to labor and capital. And economists break down the factors of production into those two items, labor and capital. And so you just tax them directly, and that's the value of those two items. And so they sum them up and apply the tax. I'd have to do a little more digging as to why they choose the subtraction method. The one item that comes to mind is the potential problems with the Interstate Commerce Clause and how you treat out-of-state companies versus in-state companies.
And it's my understanding they also do a corporate income tax or corporate profit tax.
Yeah, they have a business profits tax.
Okay. It feels like this is their business enterprise tax is a little bit of an income. You're subtracting some things from your gross sales. Right. And then you also have an income tax. It feels like there's sort of two incomes there that you're taxing.
Part of that is, in this piece, if we think back to the formulas we just went over here, this tax base doesn't include profits. So that was a piece of the first page that we went over, included costs of labor and capital and profits. Here, the profits aren't included here. They're taxed on the business profit side. It's just a different tax that they have set up.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I like at least looking at New Hampshire because they're a little bit like Oregon, a smaller state population, don't have a sales tax. And they have these two taxes on business. Not that that's necessary, not that that we're alike, but that you have those things in common.
Live free or die.
Rep. Smith Warner, did you have a question you wanted Chris to address on?
I was just gonna ask him to do the Allen X deal for the subtractive method as well. I'm trying to wrap my head around how they get, and maybe I was distracted for a second, but you may have gotten there in your description of the imaginary company for New Hampshire as well. I was just trying to wrap my head around how that makes an even equation.
Meet distraction.
Sorry.
So the potential that they could have done it is you start with gross receipts. So line one could have been gross receipts. And line two could have been minus inputs from other state or cost of goods sold. There are some accounting differences there, but that concept would be the input. And then you get at the tax base.
Okay.
Now, part of the problem there when you typically, it's hard to say typically because I don't think any states really use this method. But when you subtract your cost of goods sold or your inputs from businesses, you'd only be subtracting the inputs from in-state businesses, not out-of-state businesses. And then the warnings there are that could run afoul of the Interstate Commerce Clause. So how you avoid that is you use the addition method, which mathematically can get you to the same result, but doesn't have those problems. One of the downsides of this is the export sector. So by taxing the labor and capital, it's not a destination-based tax. It's an origin-based tax. And most states have moved to a destination-based. And that's where Oregon has done that with the single sales factor on the corporate side. And that's where a lot of the discussion in 2017 focused on the destination-based. That's what Ohio did. And so everybody selling in, the tax gets applied to everybody selling into the base, not the tax being applied to everybody producing in the state. I mean, there's some overlap between the two.
So this approach, New Hampshire approach, is a little bit harder on the state-based businesses as opposed to what we sometimes call the flyover companies that just don't have a nexus but sell their products inside the state.
I think so. That's the way it looks.
The other thing I noticed about New Hampshire is they're starting at 104,000 threshold. Some of our scenarios we've been looking at, they're all a million, which right there eliminates, you know, carpet cleaners and their small businesses, a lot of small businesses.
Yeah, they have that, and I believe the threshold is indexed to inflation. But yeah, it's a smaller threshold than Oregon has looked at recently.
Okay.
So if you go up a page,
this is a kind of flow chart I
found for the Michigan single business tax. And it's also an additive approach where the starting point there at the top, so you can go back one, up one, there we go. So that top box is business income. So it's the profits. And it's taken from the federal tax form. It's federal taxable income. So setting aside the differences between book income and tax return income, this is the profits reported on the federal tax return, federal taxable income. And then there are some items that are added to and subtracted from that base. So this is, again, thinking back to the one formula we went over with, the starting point business income is that P, the profits. And then compensation is added. So that's payments to labor. That gets added to that base. And then there are a variety of pluses and minuses. And as far as I can tell, those are trying to get at the cost of capital. Because the cost of capital can cut both ways. It can be, the company can receive interest as well as pay interest. So it'll pay interest for loans that it takes out, but it can also pay interest or pay dividends on its own stock or other investments. So those three triangles there, the compensation, additions, and subtractions, as far as I can tell, it's getting at adding labor and capital costs to the profits. And then that's how you get to the total tax base. So it's, again, it's that additive approach. And then the single, then what they did was take that total base and multiplied by an apportionment formula. And it varied over time. I don't think it ever quite got to a single sales factor. I think it got up to about a 95% sales factor. And it was gross receipts in Michigan divided by everywhere gross receipts, kind of the single sales factor apportionment. And then that resulted in the Michigan tax base. And then there are some additional deductions and exemptions that get added over time as these policies exist for a while and get worked on with every legislative session. And then they would arrive at their adjusted tax base. And then here they had one of three different calculations. One calculation would be take that tax base times the liability, or the tax base times the tax rate, you get the liability before credits. Or you could take the adjusted tax base and subtract a labor intensity deduction times the tax rate. Mm. Or you could take that adjusted tax base and subtract just gross receipts. I think it's a 50% straight off the top. You reduce that in half. Or you can use an adjusted business income. And I think that might be a small business provision. And so depending on the base there, you get the tax liability before credits. And this is how they accommodated the different sectors. So if you had a lot of labor costs, but not a lot of physical input to your firm, then you would take your tax base and you would probably choose this labor intensity deduction. And so you're subtracting labor costs. As we've seen in a couple of charts where the inputs from other businesses are more concentrated in certain sectors. We're talking manufacturing, wholesale, retail. They have a lot of physical goods, as opposed to some of the service sectors where they're more intangible or more service-oriented, so they don't have a lot of physical goods. So their costs are weighted toward labor as opposed to input costs. And so depending on that calculation, you get to the liability before tax credits. And so I think OBI was saying that their proposal is similar in some ways to this kind of approach. Yeah. And one of the key things here is you have the apportionment, so there's still an apportionment formula there. And businesses, of course, would presumably look at the different calculations and choose the one that worked out best for them. Mm-hmm. And so these are all generally the additive approach. And another thing to keep in mind is as states have implemented these and has been discussed in this committee is some kind of connection to federal law. So you can have a theoretically pure idea of what a deduction or tax base should be, but to the extent that there is information on a federal tax form that gets pretty close to that, it makes it easier to just tie for the company, for the Department of Revenue and Auditing, for the taxpayer to just take those federal calculations they're going to have to do anyway for their federal taxes, and then take that information and apply it in some way to the state tax calculation. Okay, so we bounced down to a page with a couple of bar charts. There was some information about describing Oregon's economy. And so this chart doesn't have labeled, I apologize, but it's from the Employment Department. It's covered wages. So we can see for the different sectors where the employment is, for example, the healthcare and social assistance has, as a sector, has the most employees. And then that's the chart on the left, and then the chart on the right are total wages. And you can see that manufacturing and the healthcare sectors are, in terms of wages, in terms of where people are earning their money, these are the largest sectors. Now, this is the employment department, so it's covered, the source of this information is the unemployment insurance, so it's covered wages. Mm-hmm. So the ag sector isn't as well represented here because of that.
Okay.
Is this 2017? The next
yes.
page is, so I'm kind of assuming that this
yes,
one
I think
too.
It is, and okay. I apologize. I'll fix the sourcing and so forth and get it uploaded into OLIS. And then the last chart I had here was Oregon private sector GSP. And we talked about this a little bit in some of the rankings. There was the cost study that took all of the business taxes and divided for all the different, for each state, and then divided those business taxes by the state GDP or the private sector GSP. And so this chart just shows for 2017, the private sector GSP as produced by the, or as estimated by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. And for some context purposes here, this total here is about $200 billion. Now the gross receipts total we have for Oregon is around the $300 billion total. And our income tax base is around $10 billion. So those are the two extremes, the $300 billion and the $10
billion. $10 billion being?
Income.
Yeah,
the profits. And so as these discussions and the plans come forward around a VAT, we're talking about a tax base that is somewhere between $10 billion and $300 billion. And most of the plans, I think the OBI plan or some of the others are maybe $100 billion, $125 billion, depending on how the calculations get, what gets taken out of that base or how that base is estimated. And this tax base here is about $200 billion. And that's everything. And so the tax base probably wouldn't be this large. There are a lot of imputation or a lot of calculations in here that I don't know would make it into the tax side of the situation. For calculating a tax base, a lot of these, some of these calculations wouldn't be in here. This is an estimate produced by the BEA. But again, just trying to paint a picture of the tax bases and the options that you have before you in deciding on something that's between gross receipts and an income tax, if that's the decision. And there are a lot of decision points between the two. And that's the information that I had.
Okay. Well, I think this continually helps clearing up a picture of the choices, the best choices of a gross receipts tax style, VAT tax style, or to load up on what we have now, or maybe not the best choices, but the least bad choices, however you want to frame it. Any questions of Chris? Senator Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, when you look at the different elements of a business, labor, capital, other costs, can you take us back to the we'll go to Figure One, there's a choice here for the adjusted tax base with labor intensity, so they've taken in labor into account. Or give somebody the option of thinking about it. So we would have to sit and look at how we wanted to manage each one of those businesses in determining, do the businesses get to make these choices? Who chooses?
I believe the business does. I know I need to do a little more digging for that level of detail. But conceptually, I think the argument or the justification for it is to account for the structural differences across the sectors.
Right. That's right.
Some sectors, retail trade, it's heavy on actual physical products coming in, not necessarily mm-hmm. on labor. If you have an architectural firm, that's probably heavier on labor and not on input, physical input.
Mr. Chair? Do you need to follow up?
Well, I did. But go ahead. Okay, so if you go to the next chart, on the dividends paid, the compensation paid, the interest paid, that's the money flowing out of the business. That's what I'm guessing why they call it the enterprise value. That's what it generated that year that it took out of the business. If it chose to take nothing out of the business, then apparently they don't owe tax. They just if they didn't pay any interest, it was just a pile of capital. They chose to pay no wages, and they paid no dividends. You'd have a big pile of earnings and no tax.
I suppose conceptually, I'm not sure how I can see how they may not have any interest paid or dividends paid, but I'm not sure about not having any wages paid. And maybe there's some planning around that.
Okay, and then one more question, Mr. Chair. How do you, if at all, take into account risk? None of these forms suggest any concern over risk. It's all after the fact, almost. Whatever risk you choose to take is going to result in these numbers, and then you're going to get taxed. So risk is off the table in these kind of analyses.
Risk in terms of unknown demand for their products, so they bring on a large labor force, or what kind of risk, or just any kind of risk?
Any kind of risk. So, I mean, in a law firm, for example, if someone takes a personal injury suit, considerable risk, because you don't know the outcome. Or in a business, you decide you're gonna guess. One of the witnesses last night was testifying about, on the cap and trade testimony, about the risk in farming. So they spread the risk by having 15 different types of crops. So that's how they deal with risk. And at the end of the day, they either make money or they don't. And then we see it on this sheet of paper here. So I'm just asking if you're, in your opinion, is risk off the table?
I don't think risk is ever off the table. I mean, unless there are some.
But there's no accounting for it. There's no little box here that because one business is way more risky than another, we could check.
No.
Much, yeah. Senator Burke, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm looking at the Michigan one, and Michigan is the one that repealed their corporate tax. And I'd like to find out more, and is this the one that they repealed?
Yes.
So I guess I just, because when I first heard about it, I was interested in it, and I was wondering, I never really got a clear answer on why they repealed it. I think they just said it was for political reasons, but what did they replace it with? And, you know, I'd like to know more about why they repealed it.
Okay.
And they did it some time ago, right? In
2007, I think.
2007.
Chris, when we talk about the gross receipt style, casting a wider net, overuse that phrase, and now taxpayers who hadn't paid state taxes before but sold their things here are on the hook. How does that not apply to the VAT tax? We don't have that same dynamic in the Michigan style.
I think part of that is with the addition approach. So they're not going to have labor costs in the state. So they're not located there. So they're not going to have those costs. Okay. That would be my initial thought on that. Is that so they're not part of that net. And this addition approach, we're getting at, well, let me step back. So one way to bifurcate taxes is an origin-based or a destination-based.
And is Michigan an origin-based, excuse me, Mr. Chair?
Well, it's kind of a hybrid because they start with the origin base, but then they apportion on sales, or mostly sales. And so they use the origin approach to define the base, but then by using a mostly single, not quite a single sales factor, then you kind of convert it into an origin or a destination. So it's kind of a hybrid, I guess, is the way that I'm thinking about it now. But the thing with an origin tax versus a destination, the argument for a destination is that it helps encourage the export business. It's kind of, it's very similar arguments to the single sales factor. Right. As you locate here, and if you sell out of state, then that's how you minimize. The more you sell out of state, the potentially lower the tax that you would have here. At least the smaller percentage of your federal income would be taxed here. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the origin based, you're taxing all of your production in the basis. So it's kind of counter to that export focus.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair. Chris, I apologize. I came in a few minutes late. On the New Hampshire business enterprise tax return, is this for all forms of business entities or just corporations?
I believe it's all entities.
I apologize. I'm trying to absorb this. With the New Hampshire methodology, wouldn't it be easy for sole proprietors or single member LLCs to load up their expenses and reduce their compensation, have no dividends and have nominal interest, and therefore pay minimal tax or no tax?
That's a good question. They might be able to do that on a given year. I'm not sure if they'd be able to do that long term.
How long they could do it?
How long they could do that.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking single member LLCs that, for most part, act like sole proprietors, really have the ability to expense quite a few items as it relates to IRS tax law.
Well, and there is a minimum of, I think it was $104,000 to even get in the door and paying the tax. But I'll do a little more digging on the single.
I'm just curious. I'm trying to absorb it. Mm-hmm.
Chris, do you remember off the top of your head what the percentage of Oregon businesses under $1 million is?
I think the total number of, I'm going to try and back into some math here, the total number of businesses just over 400,000. And then when we get down to $1 million and plus, we might be down to, say, 30,000. Or if I round that to 40,000, then it's 90%. Only 10% are $1 million and above. But that is off the top of my head. I'd have to confirm that. But I think it's somewhere around there.
And at $3 million?
I think we might get down to about 15,000. And I can confirm all of that and get back to the committee. Yep.
Well, that's definitely one end of the equation to consider as an important part of this. Whichever direction we go, yeah. Okay, well, Rep. Nathanson, do you have anything?
Nothing to add right this minute, thank you.
I think what we might do then is send committee members some homework this week, because I know you love to do that, and probably hold off on Thursday, which is Valentine's Day night, and I know Rep. Smith Warner has a big night planned that evening with her husband and the PTA.
Ben's better.
In the PTA.
Did you know it was Valentine's Day? It's Thursday night.
Yeah, I'm calling the florist in Ontario.
As we speak.
Right, exactly. Quickly to test. So we'll have some more. A lot of this is just digesting that some other states do, what we could do better. And so we'll meet back up here again next Tuesday night. In the meantime, check your emails. And unless there's anything else, we will adjourn.
We're going to hear from the group. I thought we were going to hear from